Hardware to Save a Planet explores the technical innovations that are giving us hope in the fight against climate change. Each episode focuses on a specific climate challenge and explores an emerging physical technology solution with the person bringing it into reality. I'm your host, Dylan Garrett. Hello and welcome to Hardware to Save a Planet. We're going to talk about microplastics today with Adam Root, the founder of Matter. Adam and his team are stopping the microplastics from textiles at their source. This is a topic that has gotten a bunch of press in recent years, and I think it's for good reason. This stuff is in the food we eat. It's in our blood, in our babies, basically everywhere on Earth, including the ocean, where we dump 2 million tons of plastic microfibers from textiles every year. In addition to the impacts on human health, this pollution is bad for marine life. And as we've discussed before on the show, ecosystem health and biodiversity are so interlinked with climate change. Matter's approach is to catch those fibers as they leave domestic and industrial washing machines, preventing them from entering the environment in the first place. They then turn those microfibers into new products for circularity. At their core of their solution is a novel filtration technology that I'm excited to hear more about. To introduce Adam quickly, he's a mechanical engineer, and before founding Matter, he worked on gas turbines at GE and then new product innovation at Dyson. He has also founded a Japanese street food business and is a surfer and volunteer scuba instructor. I've had the pleasure of chatting with him before, and he strikes me as someone with an incredible level of curiosity and energy and passion for the environment. So I'm super happy he made time for us today. Adam, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thank you. What a hell of an intro. Thanks, Dylan. Lovely to be here.
So I got to start with Japanese street food because I love okonomiyaki and I understand that's what you were doing. Where did that come from? How did that start?
Yeah. Oshietai was something that I always wanted to find out about. I never worked in food or when you're a kid, a lot of people would start off doing serving jobs and bar jobs and stuff. I always went into I worked in retail and shops selling stuff. So I was kind of always curious. So yeah, when I was at Dyson, I used to work on design on Japanese products. And I really loved and really enjoyed learning about Japanese culture. It was something that I was it's so different to what I kind of grew up with in East London. And I think that I went over to Japan and had okonomiyaki being proper beer food. It was this is great. Why do we not have this at home? So yeah, me and my wife, we both quit our jobs and we were going to cycle from Norway to Italy was the plan. And then we got about 3 and a bit weeks in. My wife unfortunately really broke her hand. We had to come home and we saved enough money to go traveling with. And we were right, well, what are we going to do? I've just quit my job for a 3 week holiday. So we just started the Japanese street food as a bit of fun and it got really out of hand. We ended up having 8 staff. We were doing 400 kilos of cabbage a week, 3,000 eggs. It got really out of hand really quickly, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, sounds like it. That's a lot of cabbage.
It is when it turns up on pallets.
And I read that the profits, so you did it as a nonprofit and the profits were going to kind of ocean positive causes, which I'm curious to maybe segue into that. Where does your love for the ocean come from and how much is that driving what you're doing today?
Yeah. I've always loved water. It's kind of my little happy place. I was lucky enough to go to university and at university, I learned to scuba dive. It was one of the courses, sign up and you can do this. So within 2 years, as most things, I kind of threw myself straight in. I was a scuba dive instructor, fully qualified, teaching people 3-4 times a week. And I've done shipwreck penetration and crazy cave dives and all sorts of mad stuff. I'm fascinated by the ocean. I think it's the closest thing we've got. Scuba diving feels like being on, I don't know if you've ever done it, but it feels like being in space. It's so alien. You're kind of just floating around. And some of the most amazing creatures are the smallest just organisms. I could watch nudibranch for hours, just tiny little critters. So yeah, I mean, I find it fascinating. I love to learn. And I think that there's so much to learn about the ocean. And I also, in the short time that I've been diving, I've seen bleaching in the Mediterranean, which is relatively close for us in the UK to get to. You can get there in an hour or two, but the Med is just bleaching and the impacts, the pollution, it's changed in 10 years, let alone if you look back 50 years. So I think we have a responsibility to do something about it. And I want to make sure that my kids and their kids can have the same experiences that I had. I think that's our responsibility. But there's definitely part of the ocean love is comes from that.
Yeah. You're not the first guest who's talked about their kind of experience in the ocean and their intimacy with the ocean being the thing that sort of, or is at least a way to really understand climate change in a much more like tangible, visible way.
Yeah. I think it's also kind of like climate crisis and what's happening and climate change and what we're trying to work towards. Fundamentally, it's about building a better society. It's a fairer, more equal, just. We're putting all of the bells and whistles on climate. It's not just, you know, if we have clean water, clean air, better quality of food. These are things that we should be wanting to get anyway. I mean, if it saves us and our standard of life, then great. But it's more important than GDP. Like, it's about quality of life. And I think that is just zooming from, regardless of the big, massive issues of climate change, actually, it's just going to be a better life that we'd be living by having these kind of processes in place.
Did your interest in the ocean lead to this kind of focus on microplastics and microfibers, or where did that come from?
It was a kind of a bit of a mix. That Genesis story talking about Oshietai and the street food thing, that was quite a pivotal point in my life. I actually had a pretty serious scuba diving incident. I nearly died in a hyperbaric chamber, like what they refer to as the bends commonly.
Oh, shit.
They put you in a pot and then it was pretty bad. Best part of 2 weeks in a little tiny, like a on land submarine. And I don't know, it must have been 25 at the time. At that time, I was kind of like, I don't know if I really want to carry on in plastic products and shifting stuff along. And like, I had a bit of a kind of moment where I was like, what am I really doing here? I mixed that with my first kind of exploratory phases about Buddhism, and I was trying to find out and learn about it. Actually, the Japanese piece, I was trying to understand why people in Japan seem so kind of together and quite chill, and I was kind of like, hang on, what's this about? And learning about Shinto Buddhism. So I'm kind of like 8 or 9 years into my Buddhist path now. It's a big part of my life, and we talk about right livelihood. So it's about basically producing, doing good in the world, and the ocean piece, this kind of right livelihood piece, and then my skill set, there was kind of a little bit in the middle where I was like, I think there's something here. And then I followed the numbers. I'm an engineer, looked at all the pollution in the world, looked at where all the big sources were. I think microplastic was just something that nobody was dealing with. And it was one of the biggest problems. That's a little bit where I'm at.
Wow. That's a crazy story. I imagine 2 weeks in an on-land submarine for somebody with your energy and curiosity was pretty tough.
Yeah. It changed me and my outlook for definite.
Yeah. Wow. So I want to hear more about your perspective on why microplastics are such a big problem. I mean, we read so much about how like they've like breached the blood-brain barrier. They're in every corner of the earth. They're impacting wildlife. What is it that kind of makes you realize like this is really a thing that needs to be addressed?
Yeah. So there's kind of three major challenges. And as you say, the pervasiveness, how abundant it is in all our natural environment, it's a failure in design. Fundamentally, we've got a material which is designed to be almost indestructible, being used as single use product. It doesn't really make any sense in like kind of logical and design perspective. But like where the problem is, what that looks like, it's based around these three major pieces. So one of them is you have this ingestion problem. So I have kind of something I can kind of show you, but I appreciate this is a more audio version. But
yeah,
basically
we can put pictures up for listeners. Okay.
We got a little tube which represents what comes out of a domestic washing machine every single year. So we get around 240 grams of material coming from a domestic washing machine. And that material is going through the wastewater treatment plants. It ends up in the rivers and it goes into the oceans. And our oceans are designed to take nutrients from the land and then digest those and then store that. So the ocean is the largest sequester of carbon on the planet. And it also produces the majority of the world's oxygen. So this is literally like the lungs of the entire planet. And what we're doing is we're filling the food source for the lungs full of material that they can't digest. So it takes up space in the stomach of these organisms. And it also is carrying microplastics and micropollutants are carrying the toxic chemicals that get attached to them. So plastics are really, really great for bonding materials together. So we kind of design them so you can get two bits of plastic and they will bond together really well. So the design of the plastics actually absorb a lot of material. So the new science came out a little while ago talking about wastewater treatment plants are like really great because you've kind of got all these chemicals coming in And then they're really great to kind of attach all the chemicals that are to the micropollutants. So it's like a gym for all of the pollution. And it comes out really beefed up and strong, enters directly into the rivers, and then enters the food chain at the bottom. And then that accumulates, you bioaccumulate. So you'll get like a mackerel eating thousands of phytoplankton, and then that'll be eaten by a piece of tuna. And then we eat tuna as like a very simplified version of that. So you've got this bioaccumulation that is challenged. So the chemical pollution is really, really an issue. And in the States, we talk about PFAS and forever chemicals, these chemicals that we've been putting on waterproofing, on clothing. Those then fabrics will then wash off and then enter the food web, and then they take that, and then that will kind of scale up. So there's kind of these really kind of big, quite big chunky issues. And then the final piece is the human health element. So we're seeing it changing the way that people's nervous systems work. It's directly related to fertility rates. The science is coming out about it breaching the blood-brain barrier, as you mentioned, is that that's really challenging, because that's going to mean that we're struggling to do those kind of things with certain drugs. We're now doing this with effectively ingesting your T-shirt. And when you think about it, that it might have flame retardants on it, or there might be some chemical processes where you look to get the dyes and the colors, that's a real issue. And it's now at a scale that's in everywhere that you can look and see. Everywhere you look, we find it.
Yeah. And just on that point, the scale, I mean, I hadn't thought about this much before I met you, but just from textiles, so much of what we wear today contains plastic fibers, right? Essentially polymer fibers. Is that where so much of this is coming from?
About 60% of all fabric made, and that includes carpet, that includes your curtains. You think about, like, we spend over 90% of our time indoors. Just look around where you sit and where you're living, and you'll notice that the paint on the walls is plastic based. You'll notice that the carpets are synthetic fibers. You'll notice that, like, the curtains are, you literally surrounded by it in every environment that you're at. So the exposure is quite high. And then mixing that with the chemical compositions, they aren't really kind of going through the testing processes that we need to really identify about how that works and what that looks like. This is all new in the last, really since the 50s, like pre-50s. It was still plastics and there's still materials, but not in the pervasive nature that they have at the minute. So we're kind of doing this like mad kind of self-testing idea of like trying it in all our environment. So yeah, I think it is in a lot of different sources.
I imagine when you first looked at the problem, there are a lot of ways you could tackle this, or you could consider tackling this at least. You could go, okay, there's already so much of it out there in the world. How do we go and remove it from the environment? You could also go further upstream and say, all right, how do we make textiles that don't use so much plastic? You decided to, my understanding is to kind of stop it at the source from the washing machines. How did you zero in on that as the place to focus?
So I did like a map of kind of like all the big pollution sources, where they come from, what they look like, where are the big kind of challenges. And this was like 2017. So looking at like what the knowledge was and those different pollution sources, I kind of come to the conclusion you needed three things to solve a problem this big. And I think it's the same for a lot of big environmental hardware problems, or even just environmental problems. You need education. So you need to understand, and that's not like going into schools. A lot of the kids in the schools are more educated than the policy hold, you know, people who are doing the policy. So that's talking about the people who own businesses. It's educating people who are writing policy, educating some of the consumers as well. I think there's a big piece to be done about, there's a lot of things that people need to learn about. Then you've got the R&D, which is what I get paid to do. What we do as a job is research and development, developing new technologies to solve those problems. And that might be new materials. But it's also in, as you mentioned, the capture side. And then the final piece is legislation. That's the kind of bit that's going to solve it all. The stopping the source piece really came from trying to think about filtering millions of miles of water, you know, cubic meters of water, or you kind of think about the, like, go stand out on a boat and look at the ocean and think about how much fuel it would take to go, even if it was some magic solar powered boat, like just scraping all the material off and the particle size. I see it like you got a laceration on your arm. The first thing you're going to do is stop the bleeding, right? And then you start cleaning up afterwards, because unless you stop the bleeding, you're not going to be able to kind of start working on that. I agree that we still need to go and clean up and do those things. And there's like a layer on the Earth's surface, which basically just, they're naming that layer of plastic we have. But we have to stop this at source. I think that was also like, for me, the value piece as well. That's one of the key pieces for how you get to add value to the material you capture. That would be the golden goose.
Yeah. Like you said, it does sound really similar to other big environmental problems. I mean, I think about CO2, and there's kind of an ongoing debate about, should we stop emissions at the source or should we go try and clean up the atmosphere and direct air capture and all of that? There's obviously now a ton of money and effort going into direct air capture. Do you see the same thing happening eventually with cleaning up microplastics, or is it just too hard of a problem?
I think at the minute, the money is very focused. I mean, oceans as a topic is very under-resourced. I think it's part of the choosing of what we did is because I think it's really hard and I got a fair amount of energy. I thought I could drive this forward and I think I could make a dent in this. And I think I could really do something. But water and most of the stuff we're talking about is international waters, talking about really challenging political spaces. Some of the biggest polluters are some of the most corrupt governments. There's some real big challenges in there. And I think that the stopping it at source is going to see the short-term element. We will have to move towards a system that there is no concept of waste. Like, if you want to really move towards the next generation of, I don't know what you want to call that, but the cradle-to-cradle approach is the way that we think about it, is this kind of approach of removing the concepts of waste. We need to be moving towards materials which are designed to break down into microplastics, or so micropollution that is positive for the environment. That's where we've got to go long-term. We're a long step away from that. And even if there was like this magic, for instance, garment that shedded in like really lovely fibers that was dyed in the right way and built in the right way, it would take a lot of, like, we're talking about 20-year plus cycles for that to get to the developing nations and other parts of the world. So I think we have to do all of it, but we also need a plan of like, what's the most immediate, what are we going to do after that? Because our consumption is increasing. You got to nip it in the bud, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. I understand the approach is stop it at the source. This is the fastest, most immediate way to make an impact on this problem. You started with actually a consumer product called Gulp, and people should look this up. It was a successful Kickstarter campaign. It's a pretty cool looking consumer product. Why did you decide to start there?
It was a space that I really knew. So working from Dyson, working in products, really understanding how things work, I think there's a real gap in the market for consumer-related products or like white goods products that are beneficial to the environment. So not a lot of people really understand that 1/6 of all the water that we use is in the washing machine. So most places in Europe and in the US particularly, we'll be using drinking water to wash our clothes with. So 20% plus of the consumption in a household is drinking water used to clean your clothes. And in that, if you want to reduce the microplastic emissions of a household, it's one of the easiest, simplest things to do. One of the challenges of capturing micropollution is actually not the micropollution. Capturing microplastics is pretty simple. You can use a standard filter that was developed like 20 years ago. The issue with capturing microplastic is that if you can filter down to that particle size, how small it is, you capture everything else, skin cells, oils, grits, sand, and all of those things pretty much block all conventional filters. So what you have is you have this kind of agglomeration of all this horrible material that we capture. And if you can filter down to that level, then you have to do something really clever to make sure that you can retain the flow of water going through a system. Obviously, it just blocks, it backs up and will flood whatever environment you're in. If that be a washing machine or if you're building a wastewater treatment plant, you'll flood a city, which is quite expensive and a bit of a problem, and they don't really like that. So we've developed and co-developed this technology for capturing a material down to really tiny particle sizes and doing it in a way that we can capture all the horrible stuff that comes with it in a really robust, repeatable way. And we can also extract the material. So you remove the material and you don't throw away the filter. So the normal way, if you've got a Brita filter, like a water filter at home, you need to throw it away every so often. Sometimes they say they take it back. They have like magical, mystical recycling programs where they take the material back. But they're kind of like consumables. They get used up. The matter technology, what we've developed, doesn't get used up. So we're capturing the material and then removing it and then returning that back to the customer. So if you own a microplastic emission place, so for instance, a textiles factory, I could give you back the microplastic that you capture. And that could be a significant amount of raw material. So it's one of the places we looked at was about 20% material cost of what they were spending.
Wow.
we could give back to them. That's where it starts getting super exciting, when you start talking about the big numbers and the value suddenly starts talking into millions, and then people get super excited and it all, the money drives it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to look at it, but that's the end game.
Wow. So you capture it in this kind of reusable filter and people then send those microplastics back to you?
So we have a program with Gulp, the retrofit filter, where we're collecting it in the UK. So we have a UK-only model right now, but you can send it back. And we've been proven technically feasible to recycle the material. So we've stripped out the cottons and the fibers and then got the plastics. And there are processes where you can strip out the plastics and keep the cottons and the other material, the poly material. We separated out some of the dirt and the grits. And we've also started looking at them. What would you do with the material? So making new plastics or new materials. We've got an insulation we've been working on for a little while. And then we started looking at some stuff that's to do with concrete, which is, it's a really interesting space. I didn't realize how many fillers, chemical compounds you need in concrete. Just a couple of little bits. But ideally, at the minute where we're at, we're in an upcycle place. I want to get to a full circular piece, but commercial viability has to be a big part of it. Not just proving it's technically feasible, but commercially feasible.
And that filter technology, is it, can you describe how it works? I'm just curious, that sounds pretty innovative.
Yeah. So we've got quite a few patents on this. So one piece of technology we have is the, what we refer to as regenerative pressure consumption. So this is super techie. How do we go this? So basically, if you imagine most filters are holes. So basically, the hole needs to be smaller than the size of the particle that you capture. Then the particle will sit over the top of the hole and it'll be blocked. And then that is normally embedded inside the filter. We design part of that filter that it's a single layer. So the material sits on top of it. So the hole size is really, really important. We characterize the flow to make sure that when the fluid enters the filtration system, we make it, like, characterize it to do a certain thing. That basically makes sure that the particle is sitting on top of the hole and not in the hole or like half in, half out the hole. And then it sits on top, makes it like it's much easier to then push off, and then you move it round to a collection chamber. So you have areas of high velocity where things are moving really quickly, and then you have areas of low velocity where things are moving very slowly. What you want to do is you want water moving really quickly, and you want all the solids and all the materials you capture moving very slowly. And the differential between those two things, if you can do that, what you end up with is stuff that you can take out and then fluid that can move really quickly. I hope that made some sort of sense. It's one of the base principles, but there's about 9 different things that happen at once, and they happen at kind of nano micro scale. So they're like, we're talking really, really small stuff. So it is like proper particle physics, which I love, but it is super nerdy.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it must be a relatively, it sounds like it's a mechanical solution. It's about fluidics and filters and something that's robust enough to put in consumers' homes and just kind of work on its own indefinitely.
Yeah. It had to be not made of unobtainium.
Right.
Like, it needed to be like something that could be mass produced. And I think it's also a real skill to design simple things. That's really where the secret lies. It's not in can you do it, it's can you do a lot of it. We have to get scale. It has to be scale, otherwise it's pointless.
Yeah. Let's talk about that scale. What are the next steps after Gulp to get to kind of global level impact?
The core technology of Gulp is a platform. It's actually scalable. So that technology I just talked about, we've developed to work 20 liters a minute coming out of the back of a washing machine. But I also have a version in my laboratory, my office, that will do 1 million liters of water per day. It's exactly the same technology. So a standard wastewater treatment plant, one down the road from us, deals about 266 million liters of water per day. They take around 25 hours to filter their water. And they do that because they have to settle after a long period of time. They use gravity and they use time as a function to settle the material down. Now, we can do it dynamically, which means that we can do it while it's moving, which means that what takes them 25 hours, I can do in minutes. That means the flow rate that can go through can be exponentially larger. And it also means this package size can be exponentially smaller. So industrial part of our business is a big part about what we're doing next. We're moving into textiles. So the manufacture of clothing, as well as some of the major kind of distribution, there's some opportunities in textiles I'm really interested in. And then the other piece is wastewater treatment plants. I think they're a big opportunity. Municipal water's slow, but you'll get it's big money and it's also big impact. So they're quite exciting. I'm also quite excited about industrial water. So that's one part of the business. We also are working on the Gulp technology scales into washing machines. So we're manufacturing Gulp as a product for our contract manufacturers partnerships, but we're working under licenses where we're licensing that technology. So when you buy a new washing machine, it will come included. It's called the Matter Inside program. If you think of Intel Inside, it's pretty similar. Buy our technology, stick the label on the front of the machine, and we can integrate it and scale it with the other people's supply chains, which is really exciting. We get paid for that. It's a really great scalable business model for us. And then the final piece is Matter Materials, which I just talked about. What are you going to do with the materials? What's the next generation? And how are we going to drive value for our customers to make sure that when they're, how do we turn the pollution into an opportunity? So moving it from a risk into possibility of generating some revenue for them. That's the long-term stuff, but requires a lot of energy.
And on the industrial side, will it be regulation kind of causing people to adopt this? Or actually the way you described how much faster you can filter the water, maybe it's a benefit to their business.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I feel like there are a couple of people in this space, but I do feel a bit lonely at times. We're the people that kind of phone us up are like, and they're really kind of asking us to do stuff. As an example, like island nations, the wastewater treatment systems are normally massive. They're huge, great big things. So the value proposition for an island nation is that a lot of them don't have wastewater treatment plants that are kind of a position they can, you know, there's a lot of water around and they just put the pipe a little bit further out and just dump the raw sewage out, and that'd be kind of how it is. Sometimes even local to us in the UK, one of the wastewater treatment plant managers said that their system is as complicated as two tipping buckets. I mean, our water network is like Victorian. So value proposition is that we're basically bringing a 2024 solution for a problem that's been kind of around since like the late 60s, but their technology is Victorian. Like these settling tanks are big bits of holes in the ground, that is archaic. You look at Singapore and Israel and some of the people that recycle water, they have a bit more complicated technology, but it's still quite brute force design. It's like, we're just going to do this more of, which is why it's really expensive because they just use, it's not sexy engineering. It's like, we're just going to do more of this at scale. The value proposition is actually, it's energy efficiency, it's size and space. It's the value material that we capture. So I'm always looking for kind of different ways, but it is really customer centric and also regional. Like the regional pushes and pulls are so different.
So it's really not kind of a green premium thing. It's, this is a better solution to do what people are already trying to do. My next question was going to be, what is the biggest kind of commercial risk you see or the biggest challenge you see in scaling the business looking forward?
My kind of thing that keeps me up at night is that we're not moving fast enough. And there are other commercial entities moving in this space, which is amazing. Competition is great because it just means that they educate, they move, which moves my industry forward in a massive way. I've got EU ministers talking about micropollution. We've got California as a state was moving bills forward, and there's so much happening, which is great. But we have a race against time to basically, before we get to this tipping point where this material is already everywhere, this is a question about what is the position before it's going to be too late. And I don't think we're there yet, but I'm still optimistic about the resilience of this planet. However, we're pushing our luck. So you look at overfishing, you look at the pollution sources. We started talking about direct carbon capture. You want to increase the efficiency of the ocean. There's a direct carbon capture that is way more efficient than anything we would be able to design, and at a scale that we couldn't even dream about. All you need to do was turn off the pollution that we're pumping in and just give it space and time, and the ocean would do a better job. And is currently, the ocean is absorbing more CO2 than it's ever done before. That's a problem because it's acidifying, and that acidification is killing the coral. So the ocean is absorbing more CO2, significantly more than any direct air capture process we have. But because of the biodiversity pressures it's facing, it's humans, we only look at one problem at once. Solve that problem, then move into the next problem. This is a really complex web of stuff. And you move one like pin, it's hard to see what the next thing is.
I'm curious too, on the technical side, you're an engineer, you've been through this product cycle, product development process a bunch. Do you feel like there are technical engineering challenges ahead of you or have you mostly retired a lot of that risk?
As a business, we're in a late stage technology development piece with one application. There will be more technical development challenges as we move into different phases, you know, moving from washing machines to wastewater treatment plants. People look at me and go, God, are you crazy? What are you doing? They're really different. For me, it's, I just see it as fluids. We worked out the mechanism of fluid, the way that that works. And then we scaled it up and it did exactly the same as what it did at the small space. So, but there is risk that you've got to build something super robust and there's something you don't think about. I've got a really strong engineering team and I'm really fortunate that they really know what they're doing. So I think that's something that I'm less concerned about, but I think is really fun is what the next innovation is out of this business, where that looks. And I don't know where that is yet. We've got a couple of really cool ideas that we're working on, but I think the technology development we've done so far has been on a shoestring budget. And we've just started really opening up our fundraising. We've really started kind of doubling down on building a team out. These guys need a bit of time, but the stuff that's coming out the other end at the minute is just unbelievable and significantly better than what I ever designed. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I know you spent some time at Dyson and I've worked closely with some Dyson alumni. So I know that it sounds like an amazing place to be an engineer and a place that's really kind of figured out this culture of innovation and new product development and stuff. I'm curious, are you building, has that experience influenced the way you're building the Root team and culture? And as a startup, how do you build one product, but also keep an eye on these future innovations?
Yeah, I consider what we're building a technology company. I don't want to be a one-trick pony. Gulp is an incredible product. And really, if you looked at it, if you really understood what was going on the inside, it's a beast of an engineering product in itself. Very technically challenging. It looks very simple, but it's very blooming hard. I think there's a lot more to be done. And I think there's a lot more opportunities. So we're planning on dialing out on some of the core technology that we've kind of developed for a while. We're going to stick with what we've done for a bit, but in the next couple of years, we're really going to have a focus that's going to see us broaden that scope out. I think Dyson, I found it hugely influential in my career. And the thing that they do really, really well is the way that they think about innovation is completely unrelated to cost. And it's actually very rare as an engineer. Like you get a lot of companies will, they do their innovation driven by their marketing teams will kind of tell them like, oh, our customers want this new feature. Like we want you to go design this new feature and it's got to cost about this and it's got to look like this. And that isn't how Dyson really worked. It was kind of like, what do you think the world needs? What would be cool and how does that work? I don't know if you've got a Dyson product, so you might have had a stick vac. It was like, I was remember it was six times that stick vac went to the board and they said, no, we don't want it. We don't like it. This is awful. Why would anybody want to have a battery powered vacuum cleaner? Now they've stopped selling or they've stopped making like corded vacuums. It's like, it's why, if it's, they haven't stopped, they're going to, like, it's going to be in the part of that change, that shift really came because it was a better product. And it, them saying no, you have to be pretty stubborn. And I think that's one thing that Dyson, they excel at. That's something resilience is the key when you're designing things. You've got to push forward. So, loads of learnings, a lot of things to be thankful for. Also, a great place to go get some of our staff from as well, from a local employer perspective. So they're down the road from us.
Okay, so I have three last questions that I ask everybody. How optimistic or pessimistic are you about the future of the planet and why?
I've got to say I'm an optimist. There's a lot of negative news out there, but I think you get a lot less positive news, but there is a lot more positive things happening. In the UK, I think we were 40% renewable energy last year. Nobody's talking about that. I think there's a lot of really great things that have happened. And I also think that you look at the younger generations coming into the workforce, they're not taking no for an answer on this. I think the climate's going to change. I think it will get there. I think it just is going to take all of us to work and make that happen.
Who's another company or individual doing something to address climate change that's inspiring you?
Oh, there are so many. There are so many that are in this space. I think actually some of the investment companies are really, really inspiring. And Dawn and the team, Elemental Accelerator.
Oh, yeah.
I find them really inspiring. And they also, they've almost made a skill set in inspiring others. They've been running for 14 plus years, building infrastructure size changes. I think some of the policy people, there is a couple of younger members of the parliament I've seen. There was a couple of people that were pretty inspiring. I mean, I also, I'm sadly, must admit, Elon Musk, for all of his challenges, and he's probably for sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing, but the man has moved needles. He's moving stuff forward, judging by his actions sometimes with these things. Bill Gates and what he's doing with his foundation. And I don't know. There's so many people. I mean, good company, I think.
Yeah, well said. Elon gets a number of shout outs, which totally makes sense. And I love Mental Accelerator's doing. I love their kind of dual focus on climate and kind of social impact. They're awesome. What advice do you have for someone not working in climate today who wants to do something to help?
I would say mutiny.
All right.
Go and ask awkward questions in your company that you work in. Do it in a very polite, kind way, but go and challenge and go and ask, why is this our policy? And just listen to somebody give you examples of why that is. And if they can't give you a good answer, that will probably make you want to move to go work in climate. So if you're, I think, go work for the biggest company you can. Coca-Cola is a footprint of Venezuela. They're the same as a massive company, massive kind of footprint they have. If you can go work for those guys and move them to a more sustainable future, you will do more good in the world than somebody doing a startup like me trying to change this little bit until we get to the stage where it's scale up and moving forward. So don't underestimate your power, and also don't underestimate the power that you have when you vote. It's a big year in politics, but also you vote with your feet, with your job, and also with the purchases you make. So every purchase you make is an opportunity for you to vote on what you think the future should look like. So hopefully a couple of top tips.
I love that. Those are really good calls to action. Thank you. Well, Adam, that was really inspiring, and I learned a lot, and I'm really excited to see where you go. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Dana.
Hardware to Save a Planet is brought to you by Synapse. To find out more about us and how we develop hardware solutions for the world's most ambitious companies, head to synapse.com. And then make sure to search for Hardware to Save a Planet in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or anywhere you like to listen. Make sure to click subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Synapse, thanks for listening.